Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, Martin here. Last week we recorded an episode on Indigenous health during National Reconciliation Week. But as recent events in Australia and overseas remind us, true reconciliation has a long way to go. While National Reconciliation Week is an important annual event, we here at Policy Forum Pod acknowledge that the journey towards reconciliation is the responsibility of all of us every day. So with that in mind, we acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we're recording today and pay our respect to the elders, past and present. Now, let's get on with the pod. Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Martin Pierce. Policy Forum Pod is, of course, produced by policyforum.net, and we are based at Crawford School of Public Policy, the Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy school. During this time of crisis, have you thought about changing professions or upskilling? If your work has been affected by COVID-19, then you might be eligible to study with us at a reduced rate under the federal government's higher education relief package. If you're interested in topics like disaster management, food security, or environmental policy, then our new graduate certificate of environmental management online might be for you. Check it out and find out how to apply at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Now, today on the pod, we want to do something a little different. Over the last few weeks, in addition to working on the podcasts and Policy Forum, we've been working with our colleagues at Crawford School to develop a new microsite within Crawford's website. The site brings together a lot of the work that's being done around Crawford on COVID-19, the immediate and obvious policy effects and how these might play out into the future, and some of the less discussed but still really significant impacts. But the microsite doesn't just pull together current research. Staff at the school, both academics and the professional staff that support them, were asked to write a contribution reflecting on the coronavirus crisis and what they think are the key issues that need addressing, how a public policy school can go about helping provide some of those solutions, and even how their work has been changed by the crisis. It's an amazing and engaging collection of writing, which I'd really encourage you to have a look at. You can find it at crawford.anu.edu.au/COVID-19. So this week and next on the pod, we've asked some of the authors of the pieces on that microsite to tell us in their own words more about what they've written about, why it matters, and how we might go about finding those solutions. Coming up later, we're going to hear about why the crisis needs to lead for economic justice for all and how it has affected already marginalized communities in India. First, though, we're talking about leadership. Leadership is something we've seen plenty of over the last few months, and also something we've noticed by its absence in some places. And to talk us through what good leadership looks like, how we can ensure we get more of it, and the role that public policy schools like Crawford might play in that, is the school's director, Professor Helen Sullivan. Let's hear from her now.
So in my piece for the COVID-19 website, I look at leadership, which I think is one of the critical issues for public policy and indeed for economies and societies generally. But for my purposes, what I'm interested in is public policy and how policymakers lead in, but also out of the crisis. And the issue really is quite simple. We're facing a crisis of a kind that we've not experienced before in our lifetimes, most of us. Nothing anywhere like it. This dwarfs the global financial crisis. And it brings with it, the pandemic, a whole range of other things. The obvious one is recession. In Australia, we've just discovered that we are, for the first time, going into recession in 29 years. The impacts around the world are unknown, but will be huge. And you then overlay on top of that the conduct of some of the most senior leaders in the world and the ways in which they are leading and the potential consequences of that kind of leadership, both positive and negative. So for me, the issue is quite simple, is how do we think about leadership in a way that is going to sustain us through the crisis and lead us to a better place? And what are the risks to that? And my argument is, again, quite simple. We've seen through the experience of the crisis what I call resilient and reckless leadership. And resilient leadership is quite simply leadership that is competent. You have to be competent as a leader. There's no question about that. But you also have to bring with you a sense of empathy and humility. You have to be able to communicate clearly and well to people who may have every reason to be afraid and sometimes very little reason to trust you. And you have to use your personal style to create narratives that bring people together, but also encourage them to respond in ways that they might find very uncomfortable. Locking down, social distancing, all of those things. And the resilient leaders that I talk about, and we, you know, have many examples of, are women mainly, who are able to combine this competence and communication incredibly effectively. And they do things like draw on evidence and expertise in ways that enable us to be more confident about the decision-making that they go through and the decisions that they arrive at. But they also do it in a way that we feel that we're involved and that we have a stake in making a success of what's happening. Now, they do this in many, many different ways. And I think this is one of the other things about leadership that is researched a lot and talked a lot about. And we've seen in evidence throughout the crisis, you know, they rely on their own personal style. So they work to their strengths, which means that if you are Jacinta Ardern, you have a very engaging, open, friendly, I'm a mum, I understand what you're going through, that kind of style. You contrast that with Angela Merkel, who is a scientist and uses that scientific background to communicate clearly about the science of the pandemic and builds confidence in the decisions that she's taking because she is drawing on her own experience and expertise. So there's a whole bunch of things there that go into what I think is resilient leadership. And I think the key thing, though, in terms of moving from the crisis to the what's next, is that these leaders consider the what's next question, both in terms of what the answers might be, but more importantly, how we might arrive at those answers. So it's thinking very collaboratively, thinking very engagingly with a wide variety of experts and us as members of the public about what we do next and how we go forward. The other approach that I talk about is what I call reckless leadership. And that, you know, is quite obviously the opposite of everything I've just said. And we do have a great example of this kind of leadership. Donald Trump is consistently a leader who is careless about his language. He's careless about institutions. He's careless about the way in which he engages with people. He is somebody who uses his leadership to identify enemies, to minimize the credentials of experts and to trash institutions that get in the way of what he's doing. He's not the only one, but I suppose he's the kind of the emblem of this kind of leadership. And one of the challenges, of course, is that kind of leadership seems to work in the world that we have of polarized politics, of digital misinformation and collapsing trust in institutions. Reckless leaders find that very fertile ground for the kind of leadership they espouse. And again, we only have to look at what's going on in the United States at the moment to see that in practice. Now, as I said earlier, this isn't just about politics. This kind of leadership is evident everywhere. The job of public policy schools, though, is to think about how we can help leaders engaged in public policy decision making to do things better. And this is where I think public policy schools have a great opportunity to be supportive and engaging in encouraging leadership of a resilient rather than a reckless kind. And I say that because public policy schools, by and large, are schools that have a very applied focus. So they are staffed by academics and professionals who understand the world of public policy and are very keen to ensure that the work that we do is communicated as effectively as it can be to practitioners. And we do that through our research, but also through our education programs. But we also have, I think, through the composition of public policy schools, we're multidisciplinary. We combine people with long traditions of attachment to public service organizations, as well as people who are what we might call, you know, traditional academics. And all of that comes together in a way in which conversations are constantly about testing out ideas and being challenged and critiqued, but very much with a view to, well, how do we get to a better position? How do we get to a policy framework that is actually appropriate for the age that we're living in? And that's going to be a huge challenge. But it is something that public policy schools, I think, are well positioned to meet. Now, they take all sorts of different forms. You know, Crawford is a school that is multidisciplinary, but has a strong core of economics of various different kinds. Different public policy schools have different bases. What's important about it, though, is that ideas are contested and ideas are tested for how practical they are. Now, what all that might mean for leadership, I think, is a couple of things. It seems to me self-evident that the kind of leadership we need in the future has to be ethical leadership. If we're to restore trust in our institutions, then our leaders and the systems that they lead have to be trusted. And that means thinking about the integrity of the system that you lead, but also your own conduct and what you will and won't accept. And sadly, that's going to be a challenge for some of our leaders. But nonetheless, I think it's one that they need to take up. Secondly, I think leaders need to slow down. There's a lot of attention at the moment on doing things very, very quickly. And of course, in a crisis, you have to act quickly. But the what's next question, the how we think about the future question, is one that demands a much slower response. And I think that's where public policy schools can offer really helpful advice, because we have so much content, so much substance to draw on. We can also provide alternative views, and leaders really need to seek those out. And we also need to, I think, reflect. And again, Crawford's a great laboratory for this. We have students, even now, from all over the world who study with us. Some of them are here in Australia, but all of them are studying online at the moment. And that diversity is essential for contesting ideas, because people come from different traditions, they come from different cultures, they have different values and priorities. And good public policy in our contemporary environment needs to take account of all of those perspectives. And one of the other things I think that public policy schools need to do is to recognize that evidence is not a silver bullet, and that for many communities, knowing more, simply being given more information, is not going to change their minds. People will absorb information and use it to confirm a particular worldview that they may already have. So leaders need to think really hard about, how do you connect with communities who have been systematically marginalized, discriminated against, and had no reason to trust a system that has apparently done nothing for them? So this is a challenge for public policy schools, because we set so much store by evidence. But again, here, this is where having a multidisciplinary faculty can be really helpful, because people come at knowledge with different understandings, and they can expose the ways in which what some academics might think is perfectly straightforward. They can expose the way in which that is based in a set of norms and ideas and understandings that are actually contestable. So there's a lot of ways in which I think public policy schools can help. We are, of course, already helping. But the big challenge for all of us, and my hope for the future, if you like, is that we can collectively reimagine what's possible. It seems to me that while people are talking about going back to business as usual, that is very unlikely and also undesirable. We now have an opportunity to take seriously some of the real challenges that we know that we're facing, climate change, systemic inequality, and to do things differently. And again, this is a challenge for public policy schools, but it's a challenge that I think we are equipped to face because we are institutions where ideas are contested. So my hope is that we can continue to be useful to leaders and decision makers, and that we can demonstrate through the work that we do and through the way in which we engage with each other that you can lead effectively without resorting to some of the reckless and destructive tactics that some of our very powerful leaders seem to be engaging in at the moment.
My thanks to Helen for those reflections. And you can read her piece, which is called Leading in and Out of the Crisis, on Crawford's COVID-19 section. And we'll leave links for it in the show notes. Let's take a quick break there. But when we return, we'll tackle the question of how we ensure that we have an economy that works for everybody, not just the wealthy. Join us soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Mark Kenny. Each week on the Democracy Sausage Pod, we serve up fresh, meaty analysis of Australia's politics and policy and chew the fat with some of the country's leading experts. It's the podcast for those who like sizzling scrutiny with just a touch of sauce. You can find Democracy Sausage on iTunes, Spotify, or at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, the coronavirus crisis has had a huge economic impact, and it's one that's likely to be felt for years to come. But the crisis also offers governments the opportunity to rethink and reimagine how to ensure that economies are working for all, not just the wealthy. Next up in our virtual pod studio is Professor Quentin Grafton. Quentin's piece looks at the issue of economic justice for all, what that looks like, how we might get it, and why we absolutely need it. Let's hear from Quentin now.
What I looked at is economic justice for all. And again, it responds to COVID-19, but it does so by highlighting three actions. But before I talk about the three actions that I think we need to do and do as soon as we can, I want to highlight, yes, to everyone's great surprise, COVID-19 is a calamity. But I want to highlight that there are people who are the essential workers. Sometimes they've been called the expendables in the United States. And I think that has led, I think, to some of the protests in response to how people have been treated with COVID-19 in that country. But I think it's a much more general issue. And namely that the poor, typically the young, the casual workers, the ones who have least access to financial resources are the ones who are suffering the greatest. They have the greatest job insecurity, the lowest amounts of assets typically in wealth, yet they're the ones suffering the most. And particularly in countries, and I just don't want to refer to the United States, but in countries where you don't have those healthcare systems that have universal access, at least of a quality of opportunity of access, then you have all sorts of problems. So where does this take us in terms of, you know, the world? I'm just highlighting what people, I suppose, already know. But I think it's really, really important just to simply say the following. In all, I mean all, middle and high income countries, and that would include Australia, and there's a bunch of other countries in the world that, fit that categorization. It's simply the case that we have sufficient wealth and sufficient income to be able to promote prosperity for all in those countries. And what do I mean prosperity for all? Well, it just means the sorts of things that we should expect governments to deliver, should in fact deliver. Now, I mentioned universal healthcare. Clearly, that's absolutely important in a pandemic. But universal education, basic housing, for example, the issues around, you know, public infrastructure and transport, a whole range of issues around lifelong learning in terms of education. And then, of course, the national security issues, but I mean issues around conservation in terms of making sure our environment is sustainable into the long run. All of those are the basic sorts of things that government should deliver, what some people are now calling a new social contract. And I'm arguing, as others have before me, but in the context of COVID-19, that we actually need to do something now, and we need to change how we do business, and it should not be business as usual. And certainly in those countries with the income and who can afford it, and that would include Australia, we can do so much better and so much more to make a society that we will live in both sustainable but also fairer. So what's this refresh that I'm arguing for? Again, I don't claim to be original here. Others have said this in different ways. But I'm going to argue for three actions as we get out of this COVID crisis. And first of all, is the idea of a fair share. So if we're going to have an equitable distribution in the context of taxes and of course, the expenditures associated with revenue generation by governments, then the people who can afford it the most need to pay. I mean, there's a classic case of one of the world's richest men making the point that he paid a lower proportion of his income in taxes in the United States than did his personal assistant, his secretary. So, I mean, that's the sort of absurd situations that we have. We have some of the world's largest corporations that don't, in fact, pay taxes in a whole range of countries or pay very little tax because they shift their revenues to low-tax jurisdictions. I mean, this is hard to stop. But it's obviously got to be a major priority. And so we need to make sure those who can pay, remove the all the tax deductions that many people have, and have a fairer tax system, a progressive system, but a fairer system where everyone's basically paying more or less the same proportion of tax when they have the same level of income, rather than having disproportionate burdens across different levels of income and over same levels of income. That's an obvious one, and it's an important one for Australia. The second one is really to about invest in the future, don't invest in the past. So what do I mean by that? Well, it means that, you know, public spending, and I mean from the government, either at a federal or regional or state level or local level, that should be about creating opportunities for all to prosper. It shouldn't be about taking money in terms of taxes and then handing it back in a variety of ways of subsidies to people who just have the influence to be able to access those subsidies. So invest in the future, invest in people, invest in opportunities. So there's a whole range of things that could be done in terms of sustainability. People have been calling it the green economy. Various other names have been attached to it. But it's really about making sure that we've got opportunities into the future and using the money that's scarce, that's taxpayers' dollars, in a way that provides opportunities rather than just simply redirecting money to people who have the influence to take that money. And the third, and by no means the last, and perhaps it's the most important issue of all, is, you know, give power to the people. And so we have problems in terms of representative democracy. We have, for example, in the Westminster system, we have the executive and the legislature combined together, and that has always been the case. And so that has all sorts of problems in terms of divisions of power, in terms of how governance is structured. And so we need to have the sorts of things that people have called deliberative democracy in place. What do I mean by that? It means that everyone goes beyond their ballot box, but they actually can meaningfully participate in key decision making. And that comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes, but it means the sorts of things like citizen juries. It means engaging with people on key matters of public interest. It means about providing a whole range of information to people so they can help make up the decisions in an informed way. It's about making sure that the people who do have influence to a very small number of people, who are I'm talking in a general sense here, to cabinet or ministers or prime ministers or presidents or whatever, that's open and exposed. You know, so we know who has access. So the meetings are recorded, which is not the case in some jurisdictions in Australia. That we have an integrity commission or some nature, which has the ability to get individuals to provide evidence under oath. And if they choose to lie under oath, then they would have committed perjury. I mean, these sorts of mitigating ways of ensuring that we have good governance are the sorts of things that absolutely is needed. Otherwise, it's just, you know, every 3, 4, 5 years, we will get to the ballot box. We'll have choices between just a very small number. And of course, the people who will make the key decisions are the ones who've been able to influence through large donations or various other ways the decisions of the day. And those decisions are typically not made in the national interest. And so we need to make sure that the national interest is well catered for. And so there's a variety of things, like I said, that we need to do in terms of power to the people. So, I mean, COVID, if it taught us anything, it taught us that there are some governments who have actually performed well in this crisis, and there are some governments that have performed poorly in this crisis. And so the governments that have performed well, I would argue, have done so because they've operated in the national interest. Not necessarily in their own political interests, but in fact, it's benefited them, I think, enormously in the political sphere. And those who made decisions in their own individual or partisan interest against the national interest, they have, I believe, suffered and have consequences of it. So this is not a naive statement. It's just simply saying that, you know, operating in the national interest is actually in your political interest. And hopefully we can reset ourselves in terms of thinking about what needs to be done post-COVID crisis. And Bob, you know, I'm speaking to you now in June of 2020, and to me to talk about post-COVID crisis may seem premature. This is going to go on for many, many more months to come. But the point is, we do need to think to the future. We do need to think of the opportunities. And having that in mind, economic justice for all is to me a banner call to make sure that we have our systems in play in terms of our economies, in terms of how we do and manage our democracies, how we spend our money and how we invest our money to be able to create the opportunities that all of us need, whether we're Australians, whether we're Chinese, whether we're French or German, it doesn't matter, or Indians. It just means that we need to have our governments operating for us in the national interest and in the long-term interest as well. What I hope is that as we get out of this crisis, that people will fight for what they need to get at in the context of the society that they live in. And when I fight, I'm not talking about burning buildings or anything like that. I mean, by fight, I mean actually engage in the processes that are available to us. And some of those may be quite limited in some countries, but actually engage. So what they think is important actually is put on the table, is talked about, and is part of what is considered by the people who make decisions on our behalf. So that's what I would hope for more than anything else, because unless people engage, and I said that comes in many different ways and shapes and sizes and how that would operate, but unless we're engaged, the system or systems will go back to business as usual. Business as usual, and shifting it from that to something different, requires energy and effort, because the people who benefit from the business as usual system will want it to go back to business as usual, and they have the power and they have the influence. So it will require energy and effort through engagement by ordinary people for that change to take place. That's what I hope for.
My thanks to Quentin. You can read his piece and all of the contributions that we're talking about today at crawford.anu.edu.au/COVID-19. Finally today, we're heading, thematically at least, to South Asia. India reacted to the coronavirus crisis swiftly and decisively, but as you'll hear from our next speaker, Professor Kuntala Lahiri Dutt, it did so in a way that has severely impacted on the country's informal workers. Let's hear from Kuntala now.
As you know, I have been working for a long time on India, and in particular on sectors that remain often invisible. Informal mining and quarrying is my niche area of research. And when I say informal mining and quarrying, people think about, by that you mean illegal? No. When I say informal sector in India, it's a strange thing. It's a completely different thing. It's not the way we think about the economy. The economy is completely organized in a completely different way. For example, if you look at the gross value added by different sectors, you would find agriculture, manufacturing, trade and repairs, construction. These are the important sectors that add most value. But then, how much of these sectors are in informal sector, informal economy? Agriculture, 97% of the economy is informal sector. Construction, a sector that has been booming in new modern India, 75% of that is in informal sector. Trade, repair, accommodation, 56%. And mining and quarrying and manufacturing, both these sectors, are 23% each. So this is the contribution of informal sector to India's economy. If you look at employment, the estimates vary between 81 to 88%. So let's take as 85% as a, sort of middle number. But even if you take 85% of the total employment in informal sector, you would not see the true picture, because informal sector, about 10% of the workers are informal. So these are the people who are contract workers, or, the formal companies have outsourced their work and so on. So this is what I have been gradually drawn towards in my research. And obviously, it goes without saying that women comprise a huge segment of this informal sector. So when COVID-19 broke out and India announced its lockdown on March 24th at 8 p.m., the Prime Minister Narendra Modi appeared on TV and announced a lockdown effective from 12 midnight that night. So 8 p.m., shops had closed that night, people were, traveling, so the railways shut down, and the other transport, the buses and everything. And people were just thrown into this situation where they did not have many directives as to what to do and where to go and, how to move around. So let's first think about how people reacted. And, by people, if we mean the middle classes, the kind of classes that we belong to and we interact with, housewives started bitterly complaining about the lack of domestic help. The, men were complaining about having to stay at home with their, spending long hours with their wives, and so on. Some people even talked about how gender roles changed in middle-class households. But so much for that. If you think about who this lockdown really affected, it's the people who worked in informal sector. It's about 400 million people who work in informal sector in India. Now that those people were not necessarily located, in their villages and in their towns, of where they originate from when the lockdown was announced. And where do they work? They work in small-scale enterprises, small-scale industries that were actively encouraged by the Indian government during the planning period. And there's a lot of research on that, how there was a perverse incentive provided to these small-scale enterprises because medium-sized corporations were not allowed to enter in the production of non-durable consumer goods. So it was all in informal, small-scale enterprises of informal nature, you know, employing 8 to 10 labor at the most. And these people, these industries are located around the big cities in certain places. And the, you know, rural people, because agriculture sector has also not been doing very well in India, they have migrated out of their agricultural, you know, rural areas into the cities, sometimes thousands of kilometers away in these locations to work. So when lockdown happened, the first thing that happened was their wages stopped. And because these people live in very poor conditions, in unsanitary conditions, they wanted to get back home. And that's when the long queues that you see, you know, if you open reports on India, what happened during COVID-19, you would see these long queues of people, thousands of people milling around in stations trying to get back home. They wanted to get back home. There was nothing, no provision. Now, India is not new to disasters. There are floods, earthquakes, everything. If you look at the history in the last 30 years in India, you would find that there has been a lot of these, sudden emergencies. India is prepared for that. India has a disaster management authority. India knows how to provide relief centers, for example, schools, colleges, you know, immediately provide accommodation, food. India has a huge store of food in the storages of Food Corporation of India. None of these were deployed. No actions were taken, excepting the hyperactive, activeness or alacrity, I would say, with which the police force came down on managing the lockdown. So if you think about what the lessons are for us through all this, I think the lessons are that we really need to look at India's informal sector, who these people are, you know, the conditions of work, conditions of living, and what could be done. You know, when we talk about India's, you know, it's one of the largest, sixth largest economy in the world. It's one of the fastest growing economies in the world. And we just cannot ignore the huge percentage of population, 83% of its employed laborers in informal sector, and just plan for the rest of the economy. So that's what the policy, I would say, that, you know, immediate policy attention needs to be focused on. And how do we go about addressing this, you know, this? I think there has to be a complete overhaul, a complete rethink about how policies are made for Indian economy, how policies are made for labor laws. India has one of the best labor laws in the world, but none of these are applicable to these small-scale enterprises, medium enterprises. So that's something that needs to be considered with great seriousness, I would say. And, you know, I think also that the whole situation has... if the situation has caused us to sit back and think about informal sector, it has also given me a hope that perhaps the worst, is over now. You know, the young generations of India, they had never seen such human misery, you know, and images of and stories that emerged of this mass migration. You know, ever since India's partition in 1947, this huge quantity of people, number of people moving from one place to another, Indian younger generations were not aware of this. I think most middle classes, urban-based people were not aware of the informal sector. Such was the invisibility of this sector. So I think this is some, I think the whole, it was a great human misery, but it will lead to a greater policy attention, greater attention. Researchers would, probably want to know more about labor conditions in the informal sector. Well, that's my hope.
Thanks to Kuntala and all of our experts today. Some really fascinating insights on COVID-19 and its impacts. And don't forget, you can read the pieces by Kuntala, Quentin and Helen on Crawford School's COVID-19 microsite. Listeners, what did you make of today's episode? Let us know. There are many ways you can reach us. Try us on Twitter as APPS Policy Forum, that's Apps Policy Forum, or send us an email, podcast@policyforum.net. And if you want to chat to our presenters and other listeners of Policy Forum Pod, Democracy Sausage, or the National Security Podcast, you should definitely join our Pod Squad on Facebook. You can find us under Policy Forum Pod there, and you will also be able to find our Ask Policy Forum Pod series. It's the podcast where you ask the questions. We'll be putting out a new episode next week, so don't forget to join us. One more important thing before you go, if you have enjoyed today's episode, you might want to hit subscribe. You can find Policy Forum Pod wherever you get your favourite shows from, Acast, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more streaming platforms. If you're loving the pod and feeling particularly generous, you could even leave us a review. We really appreciate your support. We'll be back next week with another episode of Policy Forum Pod. But until then, stay safe, stay healthy, look after yourselves and look after one another. Cheerio for now.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.